Okay, so we are now recording, and I will mute everyone if I can find the control for it. This is weird. Usually it just shows up there. Hang on just a second. I got to find the control.
Mute myself.
My controls are all over the place, it seems. Alan, can you mute all?
I don't believe so.
As a co-host, you can't? It should be in the participant window. But I can't, for some reason, I can't find where to get that now. Let me just try again.
That's it.
Do you want me to do it, Chris?
Are you able to?
There's a button called mute all. I can click on it and see what happens.
Yeah, and allow people to unmute themselves.
Yeah, continue. Okay, I think we have it.
I think you had muted me as well, which I didn't think it was going to do. I'll have to find how to permanently unmute myself. Okay, let me kick that over to Alan now to lead us through the deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We have quite a number of presenters tonight, so we'll get right into it. And I will start off with a follow-up from last week when we were talking about compressing PDF files. And if you remember, there was a bash script, which is a Linux scripting system. And if you went to the link and looked at this compressing PDF file, you will see on the screen that the line of code runs right the way across the screen and basically gets chopped off at the end here. And if you try and run that script, it actually crashes. So I got in touch with John, and he gave me the rest of the script down here, which works. So if you want to run that script in Linux, then you need to refer to this slide and get the full command line. And the second thing is John was looking for somebody who would help him with a PowerShell script, and I'm pleased to report that one of our members, Tristan, sent John a script, which apparently works quite well. So kudos to Tristan. Thanks very much, and well done. Okay, so moving along, everybody knows that we like to have people share their favorite apps for Android devices and also their programs for PCs. And Tom Trottier offered to share his thoughts, and we've got a few apps that Tom would like to talk about.
Hi. This is the app I use the most. I listen to it, I don't know, probably 10 to 30 hours a week. And it has lots and lots and lots and even more features. These are some of the features that are useful. Sleep timer, you can sort podcasts and episodes. You can back up and flat. My Pixel phone got destroyed by falling on the pavement, and I had to switch to a new phone or a new old phone. Because Podcast Addict kept all my URLs in an OPML file that's stored on Google Drive, I was able to restart Podcast Addict without any of the pain involved in loading up other apps on Android, such as R Shopping and some other apps where you actually have to put in a whole bunch of stuff. So that was very useful. You can schedule your updates and deletions even every 30 minutes. The deletions actually are after a certain amount of time. I have them scheduled so that after I've listened to a podcast, they stick around for another day, and then they get deleted automatically. You can have up to 5 concurrent downloads if you have like a gigabit fiber like some people do. Damn it. And so you can download all your megabytes of podcasts in a very short time. You can control the speed without changing the tone. This is called tempo. And I usually run my podcast at about 30% faster, or 1.3 factor. But you can set this for as a default, and you can also set it for each podcast. For example, for security now, I run at 1.6 because they're slow talkers. It has chapter support. I'll show you that in the next slide. For example, the Economist podcast, which is about a 7 or an 8 hour podcast every week, has 70 or 80 chapters that range in lengths from 15 or 30 seconds for an introduction to 15 or 20 minutes for a feature. It has episodes lists. You can download before subscribing. You can try things out. So it has lots and lots of things. Skip forward is useful. You can set these, for example, for security now. The ads are about 4 to 5 minutes, so I have to skip forward on that is about 4 to 5 minutes. You can also instruct it to skip the introduction, or for that matter, the ending, so that you can get rid of ads or announcements at the for a particular podcast. Next slide. And this is an example of The Economist. 79 chapters, and right here I'm playing number 34. Written COVID-19 and all the different chapters that are there, and it's 8 hours and 35 minutes. So it's nice to be able to go back and forth between chapters, especially if you've gone to sleep listening to them and you want to go back a few chapters to re-listen to the things that you actually were asleep during. And any questions about Podcast Addict?
Natalie says that she uses it a lot, and it's very user-friendly.
It's very feature rich. So it is user-friendly. I find it user-friendly, but there are a lot of things, and it probably takes like a day to go through all the things without understanding it, and probably more. If you really wanted to understand. But basically anything you want is there. So I would suggest it's a very useful Android podcast thing. It does have, I bought it when they were selling it, so I don't get any ads on it. But now they have a subscription service, and I'm not sure. I think it's $1 or $2 a month, and that gets you a little bit more user-friendliness, I think. But it's a free download. It's a free app, and I recommend it highly. Anything else? Okay, Cloud Library. This is part of the Ottawa Public Library, but it's actually I'm not sure. I haven't looked into it, but there are four other libraries that are. Never mind. I'll skip that. Anyway, Cloud Library, you can download and enjoy free ebooks, audiobooks, and Express titles. And in fact, all the Express titles tend to go here. So these are the newest Stephen King or the newest Anne Rice or whatever. They go here. And they stay here about 6 months or so before they get on to OverDrive and other ways of downloading things. You can browse and save titles. You can mark titles to read. It's sort and search by title or author. You can filter it. They have a variety of categories you can use that are preset, science fiction and thriller and stuff like that. You can view additional titles by author or series. You can customize the homepage bookshelves. You can display preferred genres like science fiction. You can receive reading recommendations. I just use it to look for authors that I'm interested in or books that I'm interested in. And if they aren't on the main Ottawa Public Library, then they may be here. And it's it's like, I suppose, an alternative to Audible, and it's free. And so I suggest people look into it. Speed and sleep controls, I do, they have timers like that for sleep. And the speed controls, again, I run it usually about 1.3 or about 30% faster. For ebooks, you can do a variety of things, like the font size, blah, blah, blah. And you can, I always return titles early when I'm finished. That way it makes it available for somebody else. So I recommend this, especially for fiction. I find fact books are more useful usually when they're ebooks rather than audiobooks. And I don't use this very much for ebooks. It's mainly audiobooks I use it for. Are there any questions?
Nothing on that one.
TV Kill. I used to use this when I had a phone that had an infrared emitter on it. I think it was my LG, but it seemed to kill itself. But if you're in a bar, you can use this to really be a buzzkill. I suppose it's probably most useful in like airports or other places where things are annoying, and you can point it at a TV and turn it off, and it will generally turn off the TV. It's good for a waiting room. There are other apps that you can get you can customize for particular TVs that are useful, for example, for having volume controls and turning on the teletext and stuff like that to make TVs more useful, for example, your own TV. But it's also useful for other things like TVs and bars and airport waiting spaces and waiting rooms and stuff like that. And it includes a widget, so you just have to push one area of your phone screen and all the TVs in the area will go off that you're pointed at. So this is a way to be a curmudgeon. So we're old enough now, we can be curmudgeons.
I'm not sure. I don't think I would use it in a bar, though.
Oh, you'd make a lot of people angry, but they wouldn't know who did it.
Okay, well, thanks, Tom. That was great. Okay, so moving along, my little series here on possibly moving from Windows 10 to Linux, since I won't be able to run Windows 11 on any of my computers. And we've been going through this to-do list, and we've got green check marks all the way down, and now it's time to look at my GPS system, which is a Garmin unit, which uses software called MapSource. And this is essentially a standalone GPS, so it's used for finding your way around, and you can also record tracks that you've taken, like for example, you're going to hike, and you can record the track, and then you can play it back later on and use it for route finding. The MapSource software basically acts as topo maps. So I have them for Canada and the US, but they're also available essentially worldwide. However, the Garmin ones you have to pay for. But the neat thing is that it will also accept OpenStreetMaps, which I have used, for example, in Europe, when I've only been going for a week or two, and it's been kind of a one-off trip. It's better to get the free map than have to pay for something you really only use once. So the software basically looks like this. You can see I'm running Topo Canada here, and you'll probably recognize this as the split in Ottawa. So the 417 is coming from downtown, then it goes off to Montreal or off to Orleans. So you can use it as a kind of an in-car GPS, I guess, or finding your way around the streets of Venice and getting lost around all the canals. But the way I use it is typically for hiking, and this is the Gatineau Park. This is the west end of Meech Lake and the Blanchette Trail. And this is a snowshoe trail these days. And this is the Wolf Trail. going up to Sky Turtle Pond here and then the pulpit, looking out over the escarpment and then back down the main trail here. And we've got the route in green and we've got various waypoints which are set all over the place. So moving to Linux, it turns out that the MapSource software itself loads and runs very easily in using Wine. And this is showing the base map set of Ontario and the Ottawa area here. And so then I tried to install the Topo Canada map. So again, I'm doing this in Wine, trying to install Topo Canada here. It's running the Windows installer, but it basically crashes. And it crashes with this error 1627 function failed. And if you look that up on the web, you won't find very much information of any use. It seems to be an obscure Windows error, and clearly Wine is not going to play nicely with this particular program. But you recall that I said that Garmin will also accept OpenStreetMap. So if on the web you go and look up Canada Maps and OpenStreetMaps, then it will take you to this page where it tells you that there are maps available for Canada, Mexico, and the US. And if you click on the Canada link, then you'll get to this page. And down the bottom here, there is an installer for MapSource. So I'm going to download that program and try and install this on Wine. So here's the Wine command running this executable OpenStreetMaps, and it basically completes successfully. And then when we load the OpenStreetMaps, this is the OpenStreetMap version of the split. You probably recognize that as being very similar to the Topo Canada map, albeit with different colors. And then I can load the hike route that I had before, the track. And you can see that I've got the track with the waypoints and the roads and all that kind of good stuff. So OpenStreetMaps in Garmin under Linux works really well using OpenStreetMaps. So I'm going to put that as a big tick, and that's good enough for my purposes. So next time we'll take a look at the next two programs on the list there. Tom is asking if MapSource has bicycle routes, not specifically unless they are mapped on the actual map. And things like footpaths are also some bicycle routes will be too, I'm sure. Okay, the next thing we have on the agenda is Stefan is going to share his screen and tell us about his batch file that he uses for his backup routines.
Okay, you should see my title screen.
Yes, we do.
Okay. So I have tasks that need to be done before the backup program can be run, and I have tasks that need to be done after the backup has completed. Most backup program can execute batch file before and after the backup procedure. However, if you want to do it like this, you need to run the backup program to test these batch file, make sure that they work correctly. So I decided to do one batch file that will do the task I want to do before the backup, after the backup, and it will also execute the backup. So what I wanted to do was to display the progress on the screen and in a log file, and this turned out to be a bit tricky. At the beginning, I want to check that all the drives that I need to be backed up are attached, and it needs to check, make sure the batch file is running as an administrator, because the backup program need to be run as an administrator. And I want the batch file to shut down the computer at the end. So the next slides is all the text of the batch file itself. I will explain what each line does. Not each line, but in general what they do. When you want to create a batch file, for example, you can take all of that text and copy it into Notepad and save the file not as a .txt, but as a .bat or .cmd. It needs to be a text file. Don't use Word for that, because Word save font information and all other things. So the first command, echo off, will prevent the command itself from being displayed. And the first character, the ampersand at the beginning, do not display echo off. So if you don't put the ampersand, you will see echo off. After that, you won't see any of the command, only the output. If you want also to hide echo off from the output stream, you just put an ampersand in front of it. The next command that I use is rem, and basically this is for remarks. Doesn't do anything. It just allows you to document your code. So if you need to go back and edit your batch file, you know what the thing does. The next thing I do is using the set command to set up three variables. The first one is backup name, and equate, and you put whatever backup name you want. So that's the 107 backup that I do on that computer. Backup script, this is what my backup program, which is Acronis, need. It's a unique ID to find out the specific backup file that need to be executed. And the backup log is where I want, what file name and where I want to save the backup log. And so that file will be saved on my desktop using backup log.txt. The next few lines, I just documented where Acronis is located and what are the arguments that we need to provide. So I need to provide the slash script colon task ID, which is basically this string here, and how to get that task ID. And one thing I've learned using that batch file, normally you can use two columns to do comments. It works fine everywhere else, except if you use them in the if statement. It generates a very strange error. It took me days to figure out what was causing that strange error. So the echo dot will echo a black line on the output screen. And the next one will echo that text, basically, computer backup script. And this is how you call the content of our variable name. So this will, on the screen, will echo basically the backup name that I've defined in that variable. Started on, and the %date% is a variable set up by the system. So this will basically give you the current date, and %time% will give you the current time. This will display it on the screen. Now I want to send the same information to the log file. So the way to do that is I do again the same command, exactly the same text. But this operator here, the bigger than, if I put two bigger than, it means to append to the file. So if the file already exists, it will just add an information at the end. If the file does not exist, it will create it. So it will send that information to the backup log file, which I defined at the beginning. This is, again, a black line. This is how you can test for if you put argument to your batch file. So this is an if statement, basically, that slash I says do a comparison that is not case sensitive. So if shutdown is all in capital letters or in all lowercase, doesn't matter. That test will do the comparison in hearing the case. The %1 means the first argument that you put after the batch file name. So if the first argument is equal to shutdown, and I just echo on the screen saying shutdown requested after the backup done, and I echo the same thing in the log file. If it's not present or not shut down, I say shutdown not requested after the backup is done, and I echo the same thing in the log file. Next thing that I do is I check for administrator rights, and I echo in the log the fact that I'm doing that. So the way to test for that The command net is a command that needs administrator write privilege to run correctly. The first bigger than null will redirect the output of that command to the null device, which is basically like a black hole for data. So it will go, it will not be displayed, it will not be saved anywhere. The second one, it's a bit trickier. It basically tell Windows to take the error coming out of that command and send it to the same place that we send the first argument. So basically, even the error message will most likely be the administrator write, like we're not there, something like that, will also be sent to that null device. But it will set that variable. So error level is any program that run when you exit that program, the error level variable is set to something depending what the programmer decided to do. Most of the time they use zero to mean there were no error. So in that case, what I do is I do a check for that variable, error level equate zero. If it's true, it means that that batch file is running with administrative write. And I echo the same thing in the backup log file. Else, if it's not equal to zero, so it return another number like 1, 2 or something like that, it means the administrator writes were not detected. So aborting the backup, I echo that in the log file, and pause will wait for me to press on the key to close that window. And after that, it will exit the batch file. I have some drives that need to be mounted and unlocked because they are encrypted. So I want to make sure that it's there before the backup is run. So I will echo that this was, I'm checking that the secure S drive is there, mounted and unlocked. Echo the same thing into my log file. And to check if the drive S is there, there's a command to do that, is if not exists or if exists, depending on how you want to do your test. But in that case, if S drive does not exist, echo S drive is not mounted or unlocked, aborting again the backup, and I echo the same thing into the log file. This one, I use a different command instead of using pause. I could have used pause, would have done the same thing, but Windows offer another command that is timeout, that will be wait for a certain amount of time, and you indicate that using the switch/T, and if you put -1, it will wait forever until you press a key to continue, and after that, it will exist. If S drive was mounted and unlocked, this will not run, it will go here, and it will echo into the screen. The drive S is there, it's mounted and unlocked, and it will echo the same thing into the log file. Next thing I need to check is to make sure that my USB drive on which the backup will be safe. And this one is always mapped to the P drive. Make sure that it's connected. So I didn't forget to put it in, or sometime, even though I put it in, it takes a couple of seconds for Windows to recognize it. So if the batch file run and it's not there, it will detect that. So I go the same thing into the log file, and here I put a label that I call check primary, and you will see how that thing is being used. So I use the same command as I used before. So if exists P drive, go to do backup, and do backup is another label that is further down. It's on the next slide, but it's further down on the file. So if P does not exist, you will run that command. So the choice command will display a prompt, and the choice that you can press on the keyboard is either yes, capital like Y or N. The message is going to be USB. This is what it will display on the screen. USB P drive is not connected. Try again. And you will put the yes, no at the end of that with a question mark. And the way you figure out what choice was pressed by the user is by using error level. And the first character is going to be 1, the second one is going to be 2. So if we press yes, error level will be 1, so it will go to check primary. So it will go back here and try again to make sure that it's there. And If you press no, do not try again, it will just echo abortant backup, and it will also put that in the log, and it will pause. If you don't put pause there or out of the place I use pause, the window will close right away, and you will not have time to see what happened. Now we're, the next part of the batch file is to starting the backup itself. So remember that label do backup. So it will jump here basically. The first thing that I echo is the fact that the primary backup drive is connected, and I echo the same thing to the log file. And I'm echoing starting the Acronis backup strict and I backup script, and I'm putting the backup name, and the status itself will be shown in the taskbar. If you put your mouse over it, you will see the percentage increasing. And you echo the same thing in the log file. This is the command to start the Acronis True Image program with the backup script information. That's in the batch file, that's what takes the most time, depending on how many change I've done during the day on that computer. It can take a few minutes to do that incremental backup. When the program exits, I make sure that it terminated with an EQ is not equate to. So if it's zero, basically the backup finished without error, it will go here. It will execute these echo statements. So backup completed without any errors, echo the same thing into the log file. But if there was an error, well, the backup was being performed, it will just say Acronis backup fail, aborting, and it will just, that command here, message, it will display a dialog box on the screen as a window. And username is a system variable. That is basically the username that you use for that account. And after that, you put a message. So it will just, a window will pop up telling me basically backup fail. And exit one, it means that it will exit that batch file and returning an error level of one. Once the backup is done, what I want to do is to copy the backup I just created on that 4 terabyte disk and copy it to another USB drive, just in case one of them fail, I have a copy, I have 2 copies of the backup. So the first thing I need to do is to make sure that the secondary backup drive, which is always mounted as I, is connected, echoing the same information into the backup log. So I do the same thing as I did before. If not exists, I, secondary backup drive is not connected, and I will skip, basically I will be skipping RoboCopy. But if the I drive is there, and I say, yes, the drive is there, it's connected, and I will be starting RoboCopy. RoboCopy is a utility in Windows. It's robust copy, and it has a lot more of option than copy, and it can recover many error better than the basic copy command. So basically, I'm telling RoboCopy, the source information is the P drive, the destination is the I drive, that folder. These are the files that I want to look at. So it will substitute this with the backup name, and it will look for the incremental file, all of them. And it will create a log, and the plus sign here means that it will happen to the log, and it will use the same log file that I'm using. And this will copy basically only the new incremental file from the primary backup drive to the secondary backup drive. And when you finish that, it will display on the screen RoboCopy done, adding the secondary backup drive byte free to log. And the way I do that is using the dir command. So I ask the system to do a listing of all the file in the I Acronis backup file. And this command here, I use the one that I have on my machine. It's called grep. So you look for that text in all of the files, only showing the lines in that file that have these characters. and this vertical line here is the pipe. So what it will do, it will take the output of the directory command. Instead of sending it to the screen, it will send it directly as an input to grep, and grep will only echo the lines that have byte free. If you don't have grep on your system, fine does the same thing. It's just that grep is more advanced, but for that basic function, fine will have done the same job basically. And I redo the same command again to echo that information into the backup log. The reason I'm doing that, I want to make sure that I don't run out of space on my, because it's smaller than the primary, which is 4 terabytes. When he's done all of that, he echo on the screen, computer backup screen, backup name, completed on, and again, the date and the time, and he echo the same thing into the log file. And he check if we ask when we started that batch file, if we put as an argument shutdown. If he does find shutdown, he will, as a comment indicate, he will shut down the computers. It will indicate shutdown requested, shutting down the computer in 2 minutes. And the command to do that is shutdown. The slash S means to shut down the system. And the slash T with a number is the number of seconds that you want the system to wait. So I put 120 seconds, which is 2 minutes. And after that, you see, if you're watching that running live, it will do the same thing if you have pressed shutdown on the start menu. But I have added something. If you run again that command, you can abort the shutdown. So, and the way to do that, I use the command choice, and I will display only one choice, which is A. And the message will be to abort shutdown, press, and it will display A basically. And if somebody press A, it will do the shutdown abort. So the computer will not shut down. Because it happens sometimes that it takes so much time to do the incremental backup that I go do something else. I come back and say, oh yeah, I forgot to do that. And I see that it's still at the shutdown. So I will press abort and I don't have to reboot my computer. And when you finish all of this, it echo done, and the same thing into the backlog, and it pause. And most likely that by that time, if I was, if I don't do the abort shutdown, the computer will just shut down. So if I look, when you have that in one text file and you change the extension to say .bat, to run it as an administrator, what you need to do, you need to create a shortcut. So the way to do that is you select your like Acronis backup.bat, and instead of doing open, you go to that command at the bottom, create shortcut. And this will create a shortcut to that batch file. After that, you select that batch file and you select properties. You will get this window here that gives you the property of that batch file, and you click on advanced here, and there's another window that will pop up. It's called the advanced properties, and you put a check mark here, run as an administrator, and you click OK and apply and OK, and now that batch file, if you run it, it will run as an administrator. And you can just, when I'm ready to do my backup, I connect the two drive that I need, and I double click on that icon there for the shortcut, and it will run the batch file. So when you run the batch file, it looks something like this on the screen. So Acronis backup shutdown, because I created one that do the same thing but does not call for the shutdown. So you probably recognize all the various echo statement that I put in the batch file. So computer backup script on that machine started on Thursday, 16th of December at 21:12. Shutdown requested after the backup. Checking for administrator rights. Administrator right detected. Checking if the S drive is there. Yes, the drive is there. Checking if the primary is there. And if it does not detect it, this is when you do a loop. Allow me to not have to stop the batch file and restart it again. I can just press, yeah, try again, yes, 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 and Windows will recognize the drive at one point in time, and it will continue with the batch file. And this is the line that takes the most time. I didn't wait for it to do that screenshot, but all the other commands will appear after that. Most of the time, what I do is I just connect all of this, I press go, and I just let do his thing in the morning. If my computer is shut down, it means that everything went fine. But if I want to make sure that everything was okay, especially if I want to look at how much free space I have on the secondary backup drive, I can just open the text file, the log file, and it's basically all of the same statement that we have on the screen that are in that text file, basically. So I can look at it and make sure everything was going fine. And you can see here, like starting acronym backup, and after that acronym backup completed without any errors, checking if the secondary drive backup is connected. And yes, it's connected, started robocopy, and that information there is being, if you want, produced by the utility robocopy, robust file copy for Windows, when it was started, the source, the destination, and the option that have been, that are being used to do that copy. If you want to know what all of these things do, you can just type on a command prompt, robocopy, slash question mark, and it will give you, they have a lot of options that you can do with robocopy. And he found a number of files. It was, and the file 13, I guess, was the 13th file on the on that drive. He discovered it was a new file. It was not present on the destination file. It was a 6.6 gigabyte file, and this is an incremental backup. So he basically copied that file from the P drive to the I drive. After that, he gave you a summary of how many directories he found, how many files, and in that case, he found 13 files. He copied one and skipped 12, how many bytes they were, and how much time that it took. And after that, he displayed the robocopy done. And after that, I'm going that to check how much free byte I have on the on the I drive. So that's the line that is being displayed by that grep command or define. So I can see that I have about 735 gigabytes free space on that disk. I can do a lot of backup before I fill that up. And when the computer script itself finished the date and time, and the shutdown was requested, shutting down the computer in 2 minutes, and after that, it just shut down the computer. So with that batch file, it gives you an idea of all the various, like you can do tests, check for input parameters, that kind of stuff. So it can be useful if you want to develop your own batch file for a task that you need to do often, like check for if various things are there before you do something. Any questions?
We just have one from Tom. Instead of two echoes, have you thought of using the T command in PowerShell? Using PowerShell seems to be a little bit overkill to just avoid having two echoes.
Yeah, and I'm not that familiar with PowerShell, so I will have to learn PowerShell to I was looking for a command. I don't know if it exists, if that command exists for the regular DOS, like a batch file, command. I don't know. Yes, it will have been useful.
Yeah, there are some ports of Unix utilities that will give you the equivalent of T. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, if you just look for ports of Unix shell commands and that. Okay. Thanks very much, Stefan. That was very, very detailed and covered a lot of information. So I think that was all we had in terms of question. We did have Tristan posted a link to the for robocopy the commands. It's very, very big document. I've used robocopy. It's very powerful.
Tom's asking you if you can have a copy of the bat file. It will be posted as a PDF, so you could always cut and paste, I guess. But
yeah,
don't know whether Stefan wants to provide a copy of the batch file for people. Okay, so
Alan, I will send you the file by email.
Okay, thanks very much.
I will I will change the extension to .txt because I'm pretty sure that Outlook will be upset with .bat. So.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Stefan. So the next thing we have is a share from Chris, a Windows program that he's found very useful.
Yeah, key and strokes. As people probably aware of the fact that I use Cursor Highlighter for this sort of thing, but I found this other program provides some additional capabilities, so I've been playing around with it. So it's a mouse pointer highlighter, so it'll always show you where your pointer is on the screen. And so it's really great for anybody who has to do presentations. So the audience can easily see wherever your mouse pointer is at. So when you say you click here and click there, rather than, as you see on the screen now, this tiny little, Alan had a little tiny pointer that was appearing on screen, you can actually highlight it better so they can see everything. So it also will show modifier keys, such as if the Control, Alt, Shift, or the Windows key are held down. So you don't have to say, you know, I'm holding down the Control key and clicking. They'll be able to see that. They'll be able to see if the left or the right mouse button is clicked or double-clicked, and if the scroll wheel is pressed or rolled, and if it is rolled, what direction it's rolling in. And optionally, you can also have another window open, which will show you the keystrokes that you press as you're typing something in. Very customizable. It's free and open source, and I give the link there for it. It's in the chat window as well. So the next slide is a demo. So I'm going to take over the sharing, and I'm going to do my entire screen. One of the things about this is that if you are sharing over Zoom or Teams, this effect will only show on screen if you actually are sharing the whole screen rather than a window. And so you can see on screen now that I have the mouse pointer on, and so you see a blue circle. So as I point at things, you can very easily see where I'm pointing to. And I'm just looking at some files like I did for last week's share. And so I can show that if I click here, you can see the mouse icon, and it shows that I'm pushing the left mouse button. If I push the right mouse button, you can see that I've done that. If I hold down the shift key, now this is where a little bit of a deficiency in the program. It doesn't scale well in Windows. It doesn't scale at all, it seems, for the modifier keys. So you can see that tiny, tiny little shift key. If I hold down the control, you'll see the control, alt, and you can do combinations of those. So if I did a shift and click on that, as in my demo the last week, it would select from your first file all the way to the last file. So very, very handy that you can do that. Now you can modify quite a bit if I come down to the tray icon, and you can tell I'm pointing at the tray icon if you just follow my blue circle. And if I click on there, it brings up the settings dialog box. So I can change the opacity of the circle. I can change the size of the circle. I can change the color of the circle. And in here, I can choose whatever color I want. So if I wanted a green, you know, I could do that. And, you know, I could change the opacity, make it more opaque or less opaque or whatever. The mouse clicks, you can have it that it doesn't indicate when you click, or as I have it now, it does show it. So I see the icon of the mouse as I click. And if I have the modifier keys checked off there, then I will see when I hold down those modifier keys. Over here is the keystroke history. And if you can see here I have it turned off. And if I turn it on, and I'm not sure what's going to appear here now. Yeah, this is the least useful portion of the program, and I'm not sure why it's not showing up right now. But what it typically will do is down in the bottom right-hand corner here, you'll have a separate window open up, and it'll actually show keystrokes as you type them in. and you can play around with various things in that dialog box too. But I find that the portion of it to be a little bit on the flaky side. So really, that's it. Very useful program, free, open source, and I really like it. So anybody who has to do presentations over Zoom, I highly recommend you take a look at it. And with that, I will stop the share. And if we have no questions, comments, okay. So a wish list for it. I'd like hotkeys for toggling on three things. The indicate cursor position, so that's circle. Show icon on click, so that I can see the mouse, what mouse button I'm pushing down, as well as the modifier keys. I could toggle that on or off. And also the show keystroke history window, I could toggle that on and off. That would be really, really handy rather than just exiting the program and restarting the program if I want to stop and start using the program. I'd also like the hide circle indicate cursor position when the mouse pointer disappears. So if I'm watching a YouTube video or I'm presenting over presenting a PowerPoint deck, the mouse pointer disappears after a couple of seconds. Well, currently the program would still stay with the big circle showing on the screen. So I'd like it that if the mouse pointer disappears, the circle disappears as well. And an option box to just say load when Windows starts. I know I can do that pretty easily to set it up so that it automatically starts when Windows starts. It'd be just nice and easy to have it as a checkbox in the options. I have submitted all of those to the GitHub project, and I haven't heard any comments back from the author. I am going to add one more, and that's that scaling problem that he has, where I'm currently on like 43-inch monitor, so I'm scaling 300%, but those modifier keys are not scaling along with Windows. So hopefully you can modify the program to have those scale up as well. And that's it.
So Tom's asking, is it useful while computing or just while presenting?
I've actually had it on for the last week as I was developing the deck, and then I just left it turned on. It's not a problem being on as long as you don't mind having that circle on screen. So if you are on a very large monitor, you may find it useful to be able to even follow where your mouse pointer is at any point in time. You're probably a little bit less likely to want to have the showing when a mouse button is pressed, so you can toggle that part off, or when a modifier key is being pressed, and you could toggle that off. But certainly having the mouse pointer circle, you can have that on any time if it's useful to you.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So the next thing we have is a follow-up from Bob Walker. Last week he said he was going to talk some more about VPN. So, Bob, if you want to unmute your microphone, chat away.
Yeah, I'm unmuted here. And sharing my screen. Let's get to the presentation here. And okay. So, at last week's Q&A, I answered some specific questions that were asked about VPNs, and that sort of covered a little bit of information here and there. So this week I'm going to talk a little bit more about VPNs in general. What a VPN or a virtual private network is the software creates a private encrypted connection, and sometimes it's referred to as a tunnel. Between your computer, tablet, or smartphone, and a remote VPN server. And the server puts you on the internet in whatever geographic location the server is located in. And usually the VPN software lets you choose a server location, and these locations can be anywhere in the world. The VPN can be used to access internet services that aren't available in your location. And this is called geo-hopping. Some of the sites that require you to be in a specific location, like let's say Netflix, you want to watch some programs that are available on Netflix US that aren't available in Netflix Canada, they can detect if you're using a VPN and they can block you anyway. Now, Netflix tends to be sort of on and off on this. They have to try and geo-block you because the various people they license the programming from want them to do it. But on the other hand, they don't want to annoy their customers. So that it's an on-again, off-again thing with them. Just note here, a VPN can slow down your network connection. So if you're using something that tends to be connection intensive, like Zoom, you may have to turn your VPN off. Now, some VPNs offer what's called a few different features. One is called multi-hop. And this, instead of you going from your computer to a single server, it goes from to another server and another server and another server, which makes your connection more difficult to trace. And we'll get into that a little bit more in a couple of minutes. Some offer what's called split tunneling. So instead of one tunnel to the server and onto the internet, each of your connections or let's say a tab in your browser goes through a separate tunnel. And other VPNs offer Tor connections. Now, Tor is short for the Onion Router. And it's a free open source software network for enabling anonymous communication. It directs your internet traffic through a free worldwide volunteer overlay network. And at this point, it consists of more than 6,000 relays. And this conceals your location and usage from anybody conducting network surveillance or traffic analysis. This can include companies that are tracking you, or if you've done some bad things, it can include law enforcement, or if you're support human rights in China, it can include blocking your location and identity from the Chinese government. The idea behind Tor is it's intended to protect your personal privacy and everything and allow you freedom and ability to conduct confidential communications. Okay. Now, VPNs are touted a little bit to be a security tool. So if you're on a public Wi-Fi, like at Tim Hortons, Starbucks, you're in the waiting room at the hospital emergency, you're at your car dealer service waiting room waiting for your car to be fixed or whatever, others on the Wi-Fi network can view your communications. And this is typically, you know, somebody else on the Wi-Fi network with ill intent. The VPN's main role in security is when you're using a public Wi-Fi, because the VPN encrypts your communications, which may be something like your emails, your banking, shopping on Amazon or whatever, between your device, whether it's a computer, tablet, smartphone or whatever, and the VPN server. So they might be able to see your traffic, but it's just because it's encrypted, it's just a jumble. Using a VPN on a reasonably secured home network doesn't do a lot for your security, unless you're in some place like a high density location, like an apartment building. The main use of a VPN is for privacy, and even then, it's only one of many steps towards protecting your privacy. Tom Trache gave an excellent presentation a couple of weeks ago on security, and he really emphasized that security has to be done in layers, and the same goes for privacy. And privacy and security are similar, but not quite the same. Now, just a note here: some websites don't work properly if you're using a VPN. And at various times, I've had trouble with Costco, Loblaws, Home Depot, and a few others. Costco seems to be okay for now, but to be able to use these sites, I had to turn the VPN off. There's also a couple other sites that detected I was using a VPN and told me to turn it off if I wanted to connect. And the same issue applies that if you're using ad blocking or anti-tracking software as well. One of the issues with the VPN is any sites that ask to know your location will get the wrong info if you use a VPN, and especially if you're geo-hopping. So if you really want them to know your actual location, you'll have to turn your VPN off. One of the really big uses of VPNs is to use extensively for extending an organization's private networks across several locations. And because of COVID, this includes a lot of the people working from home. So if you're a government employee or you work for a big company and you're working from home, your connection with their network is usually handled through some sort of VPN software. And as well, the VPNs are used, if the company or the government organization has several sites, any connection between the sites are usually carried through a VPN. There are several good paid-for VPNs, such as NordVPN and ExpressVPN. And right now, there's some Christmas specials on. I managed to pick up a copy of NordVPN yesterday for 79% off. Avast has their SecureLine VPN, and this comes free if you have the Avast Premium or the Avast One security packages. But if you had to pay, if you pay for Avast SecureLine VPN separately, you're better off using Nord or Express VPN. There's some good free VPNs like Proton. And keep in mind, when you're choosing a VPN, check into the company's privacy policy. Some of these VPN companies sell your browsing information. They keep track of where you're going and how long you're there, and they sell this information to other companies. Now, this doesn't apply just to VPNs. It applies to any software you're looking at using. You should look at several reviews to make sure it's the right choice for you. And we read out bogus reviews that are designed to make a silk person of a sow's ear. If you go to Fred's VPN review site, that site could actually be owned by a VPN company trying to make their stuff look good. If you don't want to go through all that work looking for a VPN, there's a very good review of VPNs on PC Magazine's The Best VPN Services for 2022. And just a note here, I was talking a few seconds ago about Avast products. I did a mini presentation on Avast back in July 2020 for a Q&A session, and you can download that at the URL that's listed there. Mozilla, these are the folks that produce Firefox and Thunderbird. They also have a VPN, but unlike most of their other stuff, the VPN is not free. And considering the capabilities, it's a little bit overpriced. But that said, these funds go to support the Mozilla Foundation. And the Mozilla folks are one of the world's leading proponents of internet freedom. So if you do pay for the Mozilla VPN, you get to support one of the internet's good guys. And the catch is that it costs significantly more than the Molvad VPN that they base their VPN on. But still, if you want to be guilt-free and get a good VPN, the Mozilla isn't a bad choice either. Now, we're getting more into privacy here. If your internet activity is pretty vanilla, then worrying about privacy as opposed to worrying about security, might not be a really big concern for you. But if you use Facebook or other social media a lot, and most of these sites track you quite and gather your information, that's where they get their money. If you're involved in any political, human rights, or protest activities, if you tend to download pirated music and movies, if you go to adult websites and all sorts of other things, then you should use a VPN, and you should take additional privacy measures. A VPN gives you some tracking protection, because the VPN gives you a different IP address than your actual computer. And some VPNs change the IP address every time you connect to the VPN. This makes sites that track you by a VPN address hard to track you, and it throws them off the scent. However, a VPN on its own doesn't do anywhere near as much for your privacy as all these TV commercials would have you believe. There are several ways to get around a VPN to track you, and that includes cookies. It includes what they call fingerprinting, in which case they can identify your computer because they know its characteristics, what browsers you use, and a lot of other characteristics. There's things called super cookies and ever cookies, and these are similar to cookies, but instead of being stored on your computer or in your browser where cookies should be, they're stored elsewhere on your computer to bypass all your cookie clearing exercises. There's things called beacons, which are also known as tags or tracking pixels. And a lot of malware that gets on your computer can also track you. So for maximum privacy protection, as well as a VPN, you also need to consider a VPN that has the multi-hop, split tunneling and Tor connections. You need to look at what browsers you use, because some are a lot better than others at protecting your privacy. And protecting your privacy isn't something that Google is interested in. You have to check out what your browser privacy settings are. You want to have a look at what search engines you use. If you Google something, they track you quite extensively. Search engines like DuckDuckGo are meant to protect your privacy. You want to look at using anti-tracking and ad blocker software. And you want to really consider how you use social media like Facebook and all the rest, because these sites get a lot of their revenue from tracking you and selling your personal information to advertisers and others. I also sort of figure that if they're making money by selling your private information, they should give you a share of the profits. And there's all sorts of other ways to protect your privacy. And we'll look at covering some of these in future Q&A sessions to give you a bit more information on them. And that's it for tonight. And let me stop my share here. There we go.
Okay.
Any questions?
I think there are a bunch of comments, not necessarily questions.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of comments in the chat. So anybody who's interested, by all means, pick up the chat now, or you can pick it up on our website later on tonight.
Okay, so the final thing we have tonight is Tom Fothering comes on the call. He's interested in creating an app that will do automatic tracing for contact tracing for COVID outbreaks. And he's looking for anybody who wants to help him do that. And I saw Tom on the call a minute ago. I don't see him right now. There he is. Do you want to say anything about this, Tom? You have to unmute yourself, sorry. You have to unmute your microphone.
Okay. Does that do it?
Yes.
Okay. I've been working on this alternative approach to contact tracing, and I'm doing it in JavaScript and PHP, that kind of thing. So it's a web-based system that's not centralized, and it relies on a QR code that would be assigned a basically just a serial number that you link to whatever you want for communication. Let's say you use Proton Mail or something like that, so that you can't be identified by your email address. That's essentially it. The QR code would be, you would scan others or they would scan yours. Your presence in a particular time and location would be noted and recorded on a web server, just using your serial number. And if you came in contact with someone infected, you'd be sent a message. And that's essentially the approach. So it's quite a little bit different from other things. And it's basically, I'm not even at the proof of concept stage yet in terms of programming. I'm just doing parts of it to make sure that the more difficult elements I can take care of. But I have been doing this completely on my own, and I would really benefit from critique from others. I'd have to detail it a bit more, of course, of what I'm doing. But, you know, sometimes you overlook the obvious thing that's wrong with it or should be done with it. Whether this is really viable or not, and we could talk about just theoretically. I don't want to do a huge amount of programming, just find out there's a fatal flaw in the whole concept. So,
if people are interested in the project, they can get in touch with you at this Gmail address?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Right, so that will be on the website. And
there are several apps that do this. Google and Apple have created an API that allows governments at least to do this by having the Bluetooth on your phone identify people nearby by their Bluetooth if they have the same app. And that's been around for a year or more. There's also several other apps by, I think, MIT and maybe other places that use your location to identify people and that do that as well. So there are a lot of other applications that are probably worthwhile investigating. If you have a unique solution for this other than location of Bluetooth, then that might aid to our ability to fight COVID.
Great. I'm familiar with both of those that you mentioned, but there may be others that I haven't heard of at all. And I find both of those have some weaknesses, particularly when it comes to privacy. So.
Okay. Well, thanks, Tom. Well, maybe people who are interested can get in touch with Tom and see where we go from there. Sure. Okay. So we're a bit over time for tonight. So I'm going to skip past the any other questions. I just remind anybody who's not a member that we have a 2-for-1. If you buy a membership, you get 2 years rather than 1 year. For the price of 1 year. And next week, we're going to have a Q&A, Chris?
Yes.
Yeah, so next week, the 29th, so if you have questions or you have things that you want to share, and please send us the information to our suggestion box address. And otherwise, we'll see you all next week. And in the meantime, a big shout out to Bob Harris, who anybody on the members only forum would have seen his article or his posting about fancy fonts and how to do wonderful things. So From Chris and I, Merry Christmas, and also from Bob Harris.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week. Happy holidays, all the rest.